This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Coulter. You hear from me all the time. To my right and your left of radio, you will hear Zoe Carr, who is currently sporting a Bill Mildenhall type hand injury at this point after some inadvertent slices on the mandolin.
Yeah, I was trying to grate some cheese and I got a bit excited. I was using a Tupperware slicer, which is like next level sharp. And I was starting to get into a bit of a rhythm and feeling pretty good about it. And then, yeah, sliced most of my top of my finger off. was interesting, but the food was good. So yeah,
we'll no longer be attending Tupperware parties for anyone that is interested in that.
Yeah, don't ask.
Yeah, and the man virtually at this point, because we are still in this wonderful world of lockdown, the man who is really only days away from being able to grow the illustrious Movember Ted Lasso mustache. Welcome, Coops. Appreciate you jumping into the pod.
Good to see you guys. I'm excited for this one.
So we have alluded to it a little bit, is the greatest show on TV bar none, because Game of Thrones botched their ending completely in those last couple of seasons. Spoilers for anyone that hasn't seen that. And spoiler alert, coming into this podcast, we are talking the world of Ted Lasso. So if you have not seen season one and two, you might want to tune out now. But we are talking Ted Lasso from a couple of different perspectives. So we're obviously fans of the show, which is always nice. I would recommend you can watch it on Apple TV, I believe it is. And once you get into that thing, you will binge it real quick. Like, I know last year it was kind of the show we all needed because it was a little bit of an uplifting, positive place when everything wasn't really all that uplifting in our worlds and that sort of stuff. We were a bit late onto the show. I know from our end that we didn't see it until the whole season had come out on Apple TV, and I think we knocked it over in maybe 2 days. It was that quick.
Lockdown for the win.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it looked like. Whereas this week we had to go through the pain of having to wait every Friday. And it was a little bit of a throwback to the old days as well, of when you knew at 3 o'clock on a Friday, that's when it was going to be around. And it was a little bit harder to get through, I must admit. So Ted Lasso, for those that potentially haven't seen it, is about Jason Sudeikis is the actor involved in that, plays a college football coach that takes a job halfway around the world in England at AFC Richmond and really knows nothing about the sport. And, you know, we sort of go on his pathway as to what he goes through as a coach, all the people around him as well. But what I did love about this, other than the fact that it's just a really cool show, like it is fun to just sort of sit down and watch. There are so many deep dives you can take into this that just take you off on tangents and are absolutely relatable to coaches. And that's really the cool part. So we sort of split this up into around about six or seven little areas in particular that we're going to sort of talk about at the moment and how this show relates to coaching. It's our opinion. You don't have to agree with it. That's fine. You don't have to like the show. That's fine too. But be aware that I think poorly of you if you do not. But, you know, that's a different argument altogether. But one of the first things we look at as we get into the show is starting with a new team and setting a culture, and we're obviously about to go into this as we're starting to slowly work towards our return to being on court again. How do you go about setting a new team and setting a culture with your group? Like, Zoe, what are some of the things that you've sort of seen that can relate to our coaches out there?
I think a really big part, and you see it in the show a lot, is when you're trying to set your culture, you have to try and remove as many biases as possible when you've got a new group. You may have heard things from other people or seen something. Or the great thing about what happens in this show is he gets to know all of them. He gives them all a chance to be themselves first and just observes them in their, I suppose, natural habitat of the football pitch and at practice and all those sort of things before he starts to change anything. So he's not coming in saying my way, highway, you know, it's anything like that. He wants to see who are you and why and gets to know those athletes so then he can build that culture. He also comes in as, I don't care about wins and losses, I just care about people. And as they start to see, you know, it's hard for them to believe in the beginning, but as they start to see it evolve and then go through those, you know, even session one, and it's in the, I think, the quotables later, but, you know, Sam makes an error and he runs over fully expecting to be yelled at by Ted, and Ted's just, you know, be a goldfish. You know, off you go. Like, and Sam's sort of a bit shocked at that that was the response. But he's the biggest thing, I think, from setting that culture is he's consistent. So it's not I care about you as a person and you as players and those sort of things one week, and then I care about wins the next. He just stays consistent the whole way through. So those athletes can then buy in, and it makes for a lot more smooth sailing.
So with that, Coops, we have a lot of our coaches that sort of tend to coach the same team year on year, whether it be their child's team, which is completely understandable. Like, if you have to coach your kid so that your kid's team has a coach, 100% go and do that thing. Family life matters, as we'll touch on. But how do you go about setting a challenge for yourself like that? So a coach that's moved halfway around the world to take on a team that plays a sport that has no idea about, what are the sort of things that the coaches can look at with challenges in that space as well?
Well, I think you start with your authenticity. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter kind of where you're going or what you're doing, that the first thing you need to be is yourself. And that's going to carry huge weight. And that's obviously something that we see with Ted from the beginning, in terms of how authentic he is to who the person he is, how he operates, and the things that he values. And I think those things will transcend sport or distance or whatever they may be. And you know, I kind of come back, and I know Zoe said the word, but like, you know, one of the first things he does is he tapes up that, you know, the poster of Believe. And, you know, that's obviously this important theme to Ted, and speculating, I would think that he probably had something similar on the locker room back in Wichita State, you know, in Kansas, because he's a believer. You know, he has this positivity and this essence to him that says, hey, let's go out and we can do this. So I think that's a big one. And then the next part is, again, it kind of comes back to what Zoe was talking about. I think you just have to take that time to get your bearings and connect with people and really find out the way that people like to operate, people like to learn, and so on. And you can do that with your VJBL team. You know, whether you've coached under 12s and next year you're going into under 18s, you know, take those moments, have some sessions away from the court. You know, start to get to know your kids, know the families, you know, who are they? Why are they playing basketball? And just gathering that information on some really simple, you know, activities or time spent away from the court can establish, you know, some notes and a structure that will be able to build, again, a culture for maybe something that you weren't initially prepared for or expecting.
So you talk about believing that, Coops. Are you a big locker room person in terms of like posters on the wall, like sayings and slogans? Like, do you believe in that with your coaching?
Yeah, actually, I do. Story time, Rob.
Early.
When I got to Ballarat, when I took up the director of coaching role out there, I think it was in my second year. You know, I'd put together a coach's manual and we'd added values to the program, and we had a lot of things around terminology and expectations that we wanted to do. And for me, you know, I went to the board and I said, I want this stuff up in the locker room, you know, especially for our Siebel team at the time, but also the fact we had some younger teams going through that space is, you know, I wanted it to have a professional feel, and I wanted people to see the values and be reminded of it and have a look at it in a professional way. And I think there's validity to that. There's value to that in being reminded of it, in looking at it in a way that says, oh, wow, like the club and the coach have made time to put that up there. It looks cool. I can read it. You know, it's there. Having said that, you know, if it's just a poster, it's just a poster. And of course, you know, then it's just nothing. It's just an expensive piece of, you know, signage on a wall. But I really like the idea of having things around that can remind you, that you can point to, that you can talk to, that will just add to that environment, you know, that's so important, and the environment that you see Ted Lasso, you know, creating in the locker room.
And that's something that he's clearly brought with him. Like, as you say, that was something that was obviously from the Wichita State days. How hard is it to get people to buy into something that you're bringing from another program as opposed to something that you're creating organically with them?
Well, he doesn't make them do anything. What he does is he shows – so the sign says believe, and he believes in every single one of them, from Jamie, their best player, to, you know, some of them we don't even really hear from because they're not in the main cast.
Just the person in the red suit from Star Trek that gets killed.
They're just turning the knobs in the background. Yeah. But so he believes in them. He believes in himself. He believes in his staff. And then, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, at one stage, you know, they're right in the thick of it in the trenches, and he just says, you know, I want all eyes on me when I say this, and he turns and he hits the believe sign. So he's not saying you have to be about this sign, you have to be about these posters, you have to be about all of these things, but he incorporates it in the way, in his behaviours, and within, you know, when they need it. You know, you saw as soon as he hit that sign, all their heads come up and it's like, right, we're on here. So now it's like letting them make the decision to buy in rather than forcing them in. Because forcing them into things, like Coop said, if you could put whatever you want up on the wall, but if you don't live it, you're not consistent with it, it might as well be wallpaper.
It's such a great point. And I've seen it a lot with a lot of junior coaches, a lot of EJBL coaches that get really excited, especially maybe their first or second year, you know, in, maybe they got a VC team for the first time, and get inundated with ideas, and they're on social media and new plays and all these different things that makes, you know, coaching so fun. But with that inconsistency almost that connects to what Zoe was talking about, that's when you can lose your players really, really quickly. And so just that understanding that, you know, if I am going to come with a theme, if I am going to come with a personality, if I am saying some things, especially at the start of year, that are important to me, I have to carry them throughout the year. Yeah. And that's how I'll keep my team kind of with me on those things. So I just think it's such a great point by Zoe that those young coaches should really be conscious of.
Well, and to follow on from that, Coops, it is a case of people are always watching. So there's a scene really early on in the season where the best player, who's young, like he's very talented, but a bit of a jerk, for lack of a better term, sort of pushes the boundaries a little bit, and, you know, I'm not going to buy into this, and I'm going to sort of go my own way. And you see in the background the old player that was at the top of their game just sort of watching out of the corner of their eye, just, I'm going to see how you deal with this. Like, do you come down on them? Do you yell at them? Do you coddle them? Do you just let them get away with it? It's those kinds of things. And it's really interesting that people are always watching. And that's something we do have to be really mindful of as coaches, that we are always being watched. The world of social media, we spoke about it, I think, on last week's podcast. It sucks. Like, social media, I can't handle it. It does my head in. The only good part I see is, like, Zoe posting barbecue pictures. But that's, you know, a different argument altogether.
But please share this on social media, this pod. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. Use it for good. It's one of those things. But it is one of those areas too where you do have to be consistent because people are watching. You know, if you behave poorly in a game, there's probably someone filming that game and it will be seen and reflected. Like, it is that sort of area where we do have to be mindful because people are always watching. So if we let our standard slip once, we know that we're going to let our standard slip two or three times potentially.
Well, and it's the saying of, you know, when you're in a team environment, everybody's treated fairly but not equal, you know, because your best players, especially at a professional level, your best players are going to play. They're going to play the most amount of time. So that's not equal. You're not getting equal playing time. But what in this show is great, you know, is everyone is treated fairly. When Jamie, that their best player, starts to behave poorly, is awful to his teammates, you know, all those sort of things, he gets benched. And there's not a lot, I don't think, of coaches that would, especially at a pro level, that would have the guts to do that.
Nor would it probably turn out the same way.
And that's the one thing I did say, I think I said that to you when we watched it, like, how often he gets benched and they end up winning the game, and, you know, the players are pretty happy that Ted took a stand and all this sort of stuff. Doesn't often work out that way, that you take your best player off for a moral stand and you end up getting rewarded with a win. But it also does the bravery to do that, again, plays into his consistency of I don't care about wins and losses. I care about you being great people and great players and all those sort of things. You're not, you know, this – it's basically a punishment for being a terrible person, not being a bad player because he was their best player on the pitch at the time. And that sort of back and forward then ends up with, you know, being and ending up having that player come around and start understanding why and what the sort of person he needs to be a part of a team. But yeah, having being brave enough to do that, especially in our coaching world, is it's massive. It's really big to be able to do that with your best player.
Coops, have you ever given your players a suggestion box? And did it was it pink with glitter and streamers and all that sort of stuff?
It has a face.
No, it didn't. And no, I didn't get that far. But when I saw that amazing suggestion box, I was really disappointed in myself that I never got to that level, especially with my arts and craft skills. But I was not surprised at all about the investment that he was making in getting feedback from his group, both for their knowledge on the sport, but also to create buy-in and say, hey, look, we're all in this thing together. And for me, especially when I'm coaching my MBL one group, obviously older athletes, every Tuesday, and I borrowed this from Pete Carroll, the famous Seattle Seahawks NFL coach, we do Tell the Truth Tuesday. And so, you know, part of that is me coming through the door and saying, hey, guys, what do you got for me? You know, where are we at with this thing? You know, how are the coaches performing? How are you performing? You know, what do we need to get out on the table to make sure we're moving forward in the best way possible? And, you know, relating it back to our junior coaches, there is a way to do that with 17-year-olds and 11-year-olds. You know, I mean, you as a coach, you know, you understand your group, you understand what they're capable of giving to you. So you can frame the question, you can frame the suggestion box, so to speak, to get out of them what you need. But I think if you're not investing in asking feedback, you're really letting a huge part of developing your group or having success with your group, you know, kind of fly by.
I think what's really important about that is being able to create that environment where the athletes can come in and know that they can be honest. And as a coach, you're going to need to leave your ego at the door, because there will be a time where an athlete steps up and says, you know, what you did was wrong, or what you're doing is wrong, or something like that. And your reaction defines how the rest of that goes from then on. You know, if, you know, the whole box, you look in Ted Lasso, the whole box pretty much was calling him, do I need to use the swear word? Calling him a wanker. But the only thing he cares about is the one that says the shower pressure's rubbish in the showers. And he's like, oh, that's good. Yep. And none of the other stuff fazed him, because he's left his ego, you know, he doesn't have much of an ego, to be honest. Whatever ego he does have, he's left at the door, because he knows what the task is at hand. He knows that he needs to, you know, get this genuine feedback, wade through all the rubbish, get the genuine feedback to be able to make it better for these athletes and help. Again, that helps with buy-in. You know, I'm going to tell you something specific, then all of a sudden that thing gets fixed and it's like, wow, he listens to us. You know, he does care. This wasn't just lip service or just a task to do. He actually followed through.
Yeah, and the follow-through is key. And, I mean, you touched on the ego side of things. Great read, Ryan Holiday, Ego is the Enemy. Stillness is the Key, another Ryan Holiday. And there's a third one in there which I've gone completely blank on. But what do you got?
Obstacle is the Way.
Obstacle is the Way. It's probably the best out of the three of them too. Good job, Rob. But I would highly recommend coaches go and have a read of those three, because they are – one, easy reads, which is a really big thing. Big text, you know, nice and well spaced out. Feels like you're getting through chapters really quickly.
Pitches?
No pitches, sadly. Oh. But a very easy read, but it is a lot about the ego as a person and as a coach and those kinds of things. And it says a lot about a coach that is happy to ask for feedback and then take it on board without any harbouring any personal grudges over that too, which is not easy to do. Like it's very difficult to hear it. And as coaches, we're so used to giving feedback to people. When we get it ourselves, it's like, well, I can't act like a jerk here because I'd be annoyed at one of my players if they did that. So I have to take it on board and go from there. And I think the survey or the suggestion box was actually anonymous. One of them called him a wanker and signed their name to it just to make sure they knew who it came from.
Hope you choke on a cheeseburger or something.
So, you know, be mindful about how you maybe roll that out. But it is, I mean, Coops, you hit on it. It's really valuable. You can do that with an under-12 team. It might be as simple as, what's your favourite drill that we do at training sessions? Like, and if that's 2-on-1 continuous, great. Like, that's something we can do at our training sessions, and now I can manipulate that to get what I want out of it, but still giving the players what they want. They don't even realise it. So I think the ability to have those conversations with your players, one, will build rapport, which is a really important part, but two, allows you to find a way forward when you might be sort of running in mud a little bit. And sometimes the players have the answer that you don't have. And as much as it may pain me to say this, there are times where I've been outsmarted by 10-year-olds because they have more answers to what's going on than I potentially do.
Well, it's the massive example in the last episode, I think it is, where they've got a plan and it's not quite working in the first half in a really important game. And the coaches are in a room together and they're saying, you know, should we change it? Should we go away? Like, whatever. And the ex-player that's now on the coaching staff says, ask them. They're the ones that have to do it. And go in there and, you know, ask them what they want to do. They want to stick with the plan, and then the plan works. And part of it, I just wonder, is that because now they feel like it's theirs? You know, that they've made that decision, and so now rather than just being told what to do all the time, they've been included in the decision process. And so now there's that little bit more, hey, we've got to get this right. We said we could do this. And I don't know. It was just a really cool little moment, I thought, of, you know, we can stand on sidelines as much as we like. Having played as well and had coaches tell me things at times going, no, that's not right. That's not what's happening. But it's not the coach's fault. It's not that they don't have knowledge or they just don't have angles. They're not out there. You know, there might be three players blocking their vision of what's actually going on, or, you know, anything like that. The ref might be standing in the way. It could be anything. So I think as coaches, we do need to enlist the services of athletes more. I know I like to try and, if I think I know the answer at timeout, say, what are they doing defensively? And get them to tell me. Just so it's like, okay, does it align with what I'm seeing? If it doesn't, I've got to start looking a bit harder or get an assistant coach to keep their eyes on that. And then we can formulate our plan together. You know, and they feel like they've got a bit more ownership of what you're doing in the game plan.
Yeah, definitely. And that's not easy to give up.
No.
Like it's because there is a fear of, yeah, but if I have to ask them, then they might think I don't know about that as well. So there is it's a really fine line between it.
Especially when an answer comes that, like, you're 100% certain is not right. Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes...
it's like, oh, we'll keep an eye on it. Yeah. We'll see what
trial
happens.
And error. You know, I think we should run this offense for me. Yeah, I disagree. Yeah, but okay, cool. We'll run you as a decoy. Like, it's, you know, you run as hard as you can and you're going to get the shot. And as the players walk out, it's like, don't throw it there. Like, it's looking to the post instead. But you got to manage that a little bit. Mm. But it's that player input that really matters. You know, when you're saying kick the ball ahead, the point guard sitting there saying, well, I'd love to, but our wing doesn't run. Or the defensive guard is getting into me to the point where I cannot kick the ball ahead because I'm in self-preservation mode. Yeah. You may take that a little bit for granted.
Yeah.
So just
or they're sitting someone in captain that you can't see or something, you know, something that you miss in transition because it is quick and all those sort of things. And you think, just kick it ahead. But the most athletic player on the other team is sitting in a position that doesn't look like they're a threat, but they are. Yeah. And we can't see that because we don't have that angle.
Exactly right. Coops, how important is it to have a locker room leader, in your opinion? Like, do you let that happen organically? Do you try and manipulate that a little bit so that it's someone that you want? Like, what's your feel on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, especially on the back of the NBL 1 season that we just had, where we were so young and so inexperienced that it was really difficult. And like just coming back to those Tell the Truth Tuesdays, like some of those nights was like all you heard was crickets, because these guys just hadn't developed a presence either within the group or within basketball, even within themselves, that they did feel comfortable and able to stand up and say some things. So, I think there's value in having one or two or three guys that can be a voice, that can potentially be a voice for you sometimes if you need it, but more importantly can kind of grab the team by the scruff of the neck or put their arm around them or whatever it may be. I think organically you get pretty lucky, like that you may stumble into a team and it's like, oh wow, like that guy's got great locker room presence. I'm really lucked out here. I think, you know, you hear Corey Close talk about it, the UCLA women's coach, around, you know, how much we value the mental side and leadership, but how much are we doing to actually help people in that space? And so I think as coaches, if you recognize that there are players that could potentially be that person, you need to nurture that. You need to go and help them and talk through maybe how they can take on that responsibility to help them maybe be a leader in basketball or beyond it and help the team grow.
And when you say nurture too, it doesn't always need to be like that coddling type nurture. You know, I know when I'm at sessions, our VMPP athletes train with our SDP athletes. We don't, through sheer geography, we can't have them together every week. So I know when I go to a visit and the session's poor, I'm coming after the VMPP and I'm saying, hey, this session, there's no intensity, there's no attention to detail, fix it. And it is designed to put a little bit of pressure on, I'll be honest, but it's not designed to break them. You know, if it's not something they're capable of, I definitely won't push that. But yeah, it's teaching them that, hey, you're responsible for something other than yourself. So you're responsible for your journey, but also the level of the session, or the elite level of the session, is detrimental or helpful to your journey. So it's on you to make sure that, you know, what's being asked of the coaching staff or what you're expected to do as a group is being done. And just then helping them without realizing it, they're giving direction, they're giving feedback, they're, you know, being responsible for a session, being responsible for other people, all those sort of things. And they don't realize exactly how helpful that could become for them as they go or journey through the levels wherever they get to.
Yeah. I mean, also too, the fact that, you know, you have so much more experience in people management, you know, as a coach, like that's why you have that position. And so, you know, if you can see how a player learns or responds to whatever it may be, criticism, you know, for example, you know, that could be a teaching aspect that you can discuss with that locker room leader around, hey, you know, you're going really hard at that person, they actually respond better to this. And we had a similar example again this year where one of our leaders, who was the oldest guy on the team, who was a bit of a gruff, a very Roy Kent type character. I hadn't even set that up in my mind. I was like, oh my God, that's worked out really well, because he was really Roy Kentish. And, you know, it took him a few weeks to work out a couple of guys where he's like, oh man, like I've just been dealing with this kid the wrong way. You know, I've been yelling at him. That's not how he responds. You know, I've got to make those adjustments to try and bring us all together and move us forward.
Well, and that's in the show, isn't it? Like at one stage, Ted goes to the girlfriend of the best player to try and find out, you know, how he best responds to feedback.
Yeah, what motivates them.
Or what motivates him, yeah.
Yep. We won't say what it is, but it's...
Oh, no, she says positive reinforcement, yeah, in the end.
She does.
In the end.
It is... It's, I mean, part of the leadership sort of thing is, though, you don't want too much of the same thing.
Mm.
Like if you've got a super positive coach and then your leader is a super positive person and the sort of the 2IC is a super positive person as well, that might not be the best makeup of that leadership group as well. You do need to have a little bit of variety in there, because sometimes you do need that sort of gruff person that will come in and looking to crack heads and things like that. Sometimes you do need to have someone that will pick you up a little bit and you do need to have a little bit of variety there. So when you look at the culture, I do think you can manipulate it. I think it's a good way to do it. But you don't want to cut someone down that is showing leadership traits just because they don't suit you as well. You do have to be mindful about what's good for the team in that space. So something to just be attentive of when you're dealing with junior athletes in particular, because I can guarantee, and talking to a coach this year, they surveyed their under 18 team and they said, you know, what's the one trait you want to work on? 10 out of 10, leadership. It's like, yeah, cool. What's that mean? Like,
that's like the standard, you know, what could we be doing better in this session? Communication.
Yeah.
Like every time, communication.
No, yeah, unless yeah, there's
okay,
substance.
Easy answer. Yep.
Yeah, there has to be something more to it. So you do need to be a little bit mindful on that one as well, that not everyone wants to be a leader. Some people want to be led, and that's okay. It doesn't mean they're a bad player or a bad person or a bad whatever, but some people are wired a little bit differently. So you do need to be mindful that you're dealing with introverts, extroverts, and everything else in between with that. Moving on from the culture side of things, and I've just looked at the time, we're already gone half an hour, so this could be the longest pod every that we'll get through, but we'll see how we go. Rob Mason, we're coming for your number of about an hour and a half. Support people. So people who are around you. So it's there's that old saying that you are the product of the five people you spend the most amount of time with. So you have to be very mindful about who you have around you, unlucky for you, Zoe. But it is one of those areas that you do need to be surrounded with the right sort of people. And probably, I mean, I could talk for an hour on one person alone, Coach Beard, who is the assistant coach to Ted, maybe says fewer words than almost anybody throughout the entire show. But the impact of those words are incredible throughout the show. So for those of you that may not have seen it, Coach Beard, super loyal. Like if Ted wants something done, we'll do it without question, but we'll challenge him. Like if he doesn't agree with it, we'll sit there and say, have you thought about this? Like there's a lot of times you feel like they've had a conversation, but you never see the conversation. Like they're kind of on a similar sort of wavelength, which I think is really helpful, but there's enough of a differential between Ted's super positive believe outlook and Beard's, you know, sort of almost not critical, but, you know, happy to jump in and say, I see this a little bit differently to how you would potentially be seeing this as well. Like in-depth studier, like loves his chess, which makes me think straight away you'd be a good soccer coach because there is a lot of chess about how that's played. Like you see him real early on the plane reading a book about soccer and learning the rules. And that is a sign of a good coach because in my mind, Ted's not reading that book. Like Ted's not turning up to learn how to coach soccer. He's learning up to people manage. And the assistant coach is almost filling the gaps as to, I know Ted's not going to do this, so I am going to do this. So it's a really important area. Knows what Ted needs, knows how to take things off Ted's plate. And that, for mine, is one of the most valuable traits as an assistant coach. What problems does the head coach need to know about, and what problems do they not need to know about, and what can I stop before it gets there? And, you know, as a head coach, you go through a lot of stuff anyway. But if you can deal with less problems, I would suggest we're all going to be in a better space because of it. Super reliable. Like there is one of the episodes, and I know it was probably one of your favourites, Coops, the Beard After Hours episode, where they have a loss and Beard just goes AWOL for a little while. But they get to the next morning and everyone's a little bit concerned about, hey, where's Beard? Where's Beard? What's happened? You know, where's he at? Ted's like, no, he's good. Like, I know he is reliable. Like, he will turn up at 9 o'clock with coffees for everyone. We're fine. We don't have to worry about this. And that is the sign of a good assistant coach, someone that's reliable, always there, always able to help out when they possibly need to. Like, it's really interesting that he's got this such different life away from football that he does compared to when he's coaching. It's almost like he's a real loose dude, like away from the sport. But as soon as he's coaching, he's dialed in. Like, that's where his head's at. So how important, Coops, is a good assistant coach that can do all of that and probably more in a coaching space?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. You know, and it's not until you're really in the trenches do you find out, you know, how important that is, you know, that support staff or that person. And I think you have to trial and error it. I think you have to be really open to creating relationships and trying people out and asking questions and really investing in that side of things rather than just kind of, that's my best mate or that's someone I know that'll do it. You know what I mean? Get the background on them, find out who they are, spend some time with them. You know, it's becoming such a significant role, especially in basketball, as basketball just grows and grows as we're heading, you know, towards the number one sport in the world. And you know, being a really good assistant coach, it can be an outstanding career, you know, if you love the sport. And Sherry Cole, you know, famous women's basketball coach from the States, you know, one of her quotes that I love is, how do you get the next job? You know, be great in the job that you're in now. And I think a lot of our assistant coaches forget that. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to do this. I'll do what I need to do, but I've kind of got one eye on the door. Whereas exactly what you said, Rob, about Coach Beard, like that guy is like, this is my role and I'm going to do it to the absolute best of my ability. And it's the head coach who gets the credit. You know, it's the head coach has to take all the responsibility. But I know that I've got to be here to support him on and off the field. I've got to be here with coffee. I've got to make sure I'm the tactics guy. And so, I couldn't stress this enough to our coaches out there in our community to make sure you get this one right and really go after it and try and build the best support staff that you can.
Yeah, I think as a head coach, you know, you have so much to deal with from just a on court, off court, you know, dealing with administration, dealing with, you know, everything. The last thing you need to be fearful of or thinking about or putting any time into is the person sitting next to me trying to knife me for my job. And you see Beard, that is never the case. In fact, in season two, when Nate starts on his stupidness, he is angry by it. He's angered by it. And he tries to intervene and tries to do all that, but it doesn't. And, you know, he tries to go to Ted about it, all that sort of stuff. He is angered by the fact that somebody is openly criticizing someone who gave him such a good opportunity. So knowing you've got that loyal soldier, I think, next to you, and it doesn't mean you can't move on. This is what I think, sometimes we get confused about as coaches. Of course, a lot of the time as coaches, we have ambition. You know, we want to go and coach state teams, coach Oz teams, coach in the NBL, WNBL, whatever it might be. And it doesn't mean you can't go and do that. But the worst thing I think you can do is knife the person who gave you the opportunity to get there. And a lot of the time that comes from, well, I wanted that job yesterday, instead of I'm going to do the work today to get that job when I'm ready for it. And it becomes, impatience, I think, kills us as a coaching fraternity. It kills us in terms of our networks. It kills us in terms of, you know, because it's really hard to trust, I think, at times, you know, to have those coaches sitting next to you. I mean, it's probably pretty obvious, anyone that knows me, a lot of the time I've got Rob sitting next to me because I know he's not going to knife me to get my job. Like,
oh, I want out. Most of the time.
It's not that he's a great coach. No, I'm kidding.
I'm acutely aware of that. Don't worry about it.
No, but, you know, I must admit watching it, it was almost like, holy moly, they've put Rob in a role when how you are when you are an assistant coach. You know, super supportive, definitely calls out when he needs to, super knowledgeable, but doesn't overstep, would never, if I was to make an error, and can we all be honest as coaches, we make errors. We say things in timeouts, on court, whatever it might be, that aren't correct. It does happen. And we all just need to accept that. The amount of, Rob, I remember I said something in a practice session and then Rob walked around and came and just sort of spoke to me quietly and said, hey, it was supposed to be dot, dot, dot. You could have gone another way. You could have stopped the whole thing. You could have interrupted and you could have exposed that to the entire group. And you didn't. You let me do that, which is the way it should be. My error, my chance to redeem it. And so that's, I think I understand we all want to go somewhere. We all want that job. We all want to, you know, all those sort of things. But I think if we can just be like Beard, just, you know, if you can be like Beard, you will get there. And you'll not only get there, you'll get there the right way, as opposed to just getting there because of sort of foul play, I'll call it.
T-shirt design coming up in that without question.
Hashtag talking split on the back.
The similarities between myself and Beard don't stop there. I would also like the chicken and the beef whenever we go to any dinners anywhere. So just for future reference, if anyone's listening. As we move down the coaching staff, we get to Nate. And Nate is sort of like this lovable, goofy sort of guy early on that was really just searching to belong, I think, more than anything else. Like, would do anything for anyone, was the kit man, would worry about the field, like, would introduce, but clearly suffered from, like, a little bit of social anxiety that couldn't talk at the right time, couldn't, like, had this real inferiority complex, I feel like. Mm. And we do have a lot of coaches that are like this. And this is not a crack at anyone in particular by any means, but a lot of times we can come into coaching and be a fairly quiet person, and we go looking for where we can fit in. And Nate's growth over the course of the two seasons, and again, sorry, spoilers if you haven't listened, but he goes from being this really quiet, introverted person to end up being a head coach of a Premier League side by the end of season two. But the path he took to get there probably relates a fair bit to what you were just talking about. Mm. Didn't do it the right way, didn't have a lot of appreciation for people that have helped him along the way, got super concerned about looking the part. And there was no substance to it. Or there was substance, but it wasn't the right sort of substance. There was no connection. And you look at how West Ham were training at the end of season two, and you know, it is military-like. Like, everyone's in the right place at the right time, and he's in charge, and whistle around the neck. Like, he's in control because that's how he feels he needs to be in control, and that's the impact he can have. Whereas you look at an AFC Richmond training session, and they're choreographing, you know, Backstreet Boys. Like, it's
NSYNC.
NSYNC. Sorry. Thanks very much. Same thing. Like, in all honesty, like, but it is. It's that sort of world that, you know, that's clearly where he's searching for a young coach that's accelerated really quickly, but then got to a point where it's like, I want to continue to accelerate, but I don't really know how. Well, instead of trying to be better and climb the ladder, I'm going to try and tear those down that are sitting above me on that ladder, and that's difficult. Like, I mean, we've all been young coaches at some point, whether it be young in age or young in years of coaching. We've all probably been at that point where I can do the right thing, I can kind of do the wrong thing. You know, which one's going to be quicker? Probably the wrong thing. But which one is the right thing to do? Well, clearly the right thing. And I think that's really valuable for coaches, and in particular young coaches out there, to look at that character arc and how that's moved out over the course of two seasons. And there are some telltale signs in there, like snippy with people that are below you on the totem pole. Like, that's a real easy one. Like, if you're coaching the 12 ones, but you won't give the 12 fours coach the time of day, that's an issue straight away. You see that, I think, immediately. That's a problem.
Yeah, well, when he was the kit man, and then when the new kit man comes in, he's on him about everything. And it's almost like, because I can control that, because I know the ins and outs of it completely, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I can be this because it's the only place I have power as such. Instead of, I'm going to show you how to be. Like, you know, if you make an error, I'm going to show you how to fix it and help you through it. Instead, he wants to humiliate him and, you know, make out he's this big, strong, forceful guy, which really he's not.
No, I think there's two parts of Nate that our coaches should be really aware of. And for the regular listeners, they would have heard me say this a million times, but the importance of awareness, especially self-awareness. And yeah, that's a personal value of mine. And you actually get an episode where you get some background into Nate and his family and his relationship with his father. And if you can kind of piece it together around the inferiority and how he's always trying to prove himself and how his behavior stems from that relationship. So not saying to anyone that they've got to go into this Freudian level of psychoanalysis breakdown, but having that self-awareness around, where are my pitfalls? What are some mistakes? Maybe I'm making some consistent mistakes I'm making. How am I operating, firstly, as a person, as a coach? You have to have that. You cannot get to where you want to go without great self-awareness. You know, that's the problem. How do you solve it? A mentor is a great way to get into that aspect of developing some emotional intelligence, some self-awareness. Have some people around you that you trust that can say to you, hey, you're being a dick. Like, let's look into the reason why. So I think that's a part of it that hopefully our coaches listen to and reflect on. And then I think the second part too is how outcome-based Nate's coaching is to how process-based Ted's coaching is. And the fact that, you know, you can almost get that sensation, that feeling like what Rob was talking about, that scene of this military-esque West Ham type session that's we're training this way, you know, because, you know, I know the outcome or this is where it's going to come. Whereas Ted's process around we're going to choreograph dance or we're going to spell out high boss on the pitch with our bodies around it, you know, that joy and the environment and the more fun we're having together, the more we're connecting, that's way more important than the outcomes are going to be a byproduct. So again, is to our young coaches, don't get too far down the rabbit hole with becoming outcome obsessed.
Coops, I have a question for you. Would you have Nate at Sunderland?
Well, we won 4-0 yesterday, so I'm backing Lee Johnson right now. So no, Nate can stay at West Ham.
That is the we won versus they lost. Like it's you know, there's a very fine line between the two of them, but you've tried it very well there, Coops. The other part of that coaching staff is obviously Roy Kent, who is the former player that really sort of takes a little bit of a break from the game for a little while there, goes back and coaches his nieces under 10's team, I think it is, and effectively just swears at them the entire time. And, you know, as someone that's been there, I can appreciate that. It is difficult to do at times. But he eventually sort of wants nothing to do with the game, and that's kind of his tipping point. And Ted obviously realises there's a lot of value to have someone like that. As a former player coming in now, I went through my transition from player to coach pathway a lot earlier than most, they would suggest. You guys went through yours a little bit later. So well done to you both. But it is difficult for a lot of former players to come into a coaching space because there's a lot of stuff they now can't control and a lot of stuff where it's now no longer about them. What was the transition like for you, Zoe?
I struggled, I'll be honest. I struggled first because I didn't come straight from playing into coaching. And I'll preface this by saying I certainly wasn't as good at basketball as Roy was at football. So it would be far harder for someone like him. But I really struggled. I finished, and I'm really glad at the moment there's a lot more discussion on this sort of stuff, but I had a bit of an identity crisis of, well, if I don't play basketball, like, who am I? You know, basketball was always somewhere I could go if I was happy, if I was sad, if I was angry, if I, like, whatever, I could always go there and it was something I could control or something I could be good at, you know, all those sort of things. And then that's gone. And with that then, you know, now it's like leaving school a little bit. Now you've got to organize to see your friends when you're used to just seeing them because you'd go to practice 3, 4, 5 times and games, you know, 5 to 7 times a week. So, yeah, I really struggled with that early. And, you know, I've spoken about it on the pod before. My first coaching gig was my little niece, who's now not so little, but under 12s, 5s or 6s or something like that. And I could not be more grateful for having had done that. And it was watching Roy in this where – even just when he goes into the commentary and he says to Keely, you know, you brought me back to the game. That's how it really did feel like that, you know, like, oh, there is a way to still be around what's been so familiar and such a big part of my life for the last, you know, 15 to 20 odd years. I did struggle with the lack of control. So very early I was an overspeaker and a bit of a rah-rah coach because it's like, well, if I'm, you know, talking the whole time and that's me contributing and now I'm helping and look, guys, I'm really good at this and, you know, like, and it was terrible. But it's so learning how to understand and sometimes I struggle with it still now, but that it's not all in my control. We are at the mercy of the athletes. I could say whatever I want. At the end of the day, if they don't do it, they don't do it. And just that understanding too of if I have given a direction and they don't do it, it's not because they're just trying to, you know, give me the bird. They're, something might have happened. Something, you know, something that I didn't forecast, or, you know, there's an error, and understand that, you know, I made errors as a player. So imagine what my coaches were probably thinking when I, and, you know, trying to piece that all together. And it took a long time. But once I was back in, then it was like, yes, like I'm back home. This is familiar. This is where I want to be. So I think that void between playing and coaching, and it doesn't have to be coaching for everybody. Not everybody's going to want to coach, but I think ex-athletes in any sport need to find something to transition into, because we're so used to having this set routine, this set, you know, goal, you know, where this is what we want, this is what we're trying to achieve. And once that's gone, it's really hard to have nothing. So I think it doesn't have to be coaching. For me, it was coaching, but for anybody else, it could be some other hobby. It could be barbecuing, Rob.
Could be.
But have something, find your next passion, find something that will not only take up your time, but fill that void that is now missing.
And age plays a big part in that too. Like having someone that has just recently finished the sport as a player coming in as a coaching staff, that can be a really important part. So if you are potentially an older coach trying to get an assistant coach that's potentially a little bit more the age of the players, it can be a little bit more connected, like, and can read the locker room a little better. Like, I know as I'm starting to get older, my relationship with the younger athletes gets further and further apart. What I thought was cool apparently isn't anymore. So you do have to be a little bit mindful that you do want to have someone involved that can be a little bridge, I suppose,
yeah,
between yourself and maybe the playing group as well. Like, Coos, have you sort of found age to be a little bit of a barrier in having ex-players involved in your staff before?
Yeah, I do. Even if not age, but just a connection with like what you're saying, pop culture, however you want to frame it. You know, what are the age of the athletes? What are they interested in? What, you know, what motivates them? What can you help use to connect a relationship with? But you know, some people kind of age themselves out of that because they don't want to stay relevant in that space and prefer to live their own life. And that's okay. That authenticity can be that. And then that's why I think, yeah, importantly, kind of what you guys are saying, you can go get an assistant coach that can fill that. It's like Eddie Jones, you know, the famous rugby coach, he talks about building a staff that you should be putting together what you don't have. You know, there's all these different coaches on the spectrum. You know, find the coaches that you don't have to build the best staff possible. But I think the other thing too about, you know, Roy Kent's situation in moving from player to coach is around that the almost fundamental aspect of coaching of kind of telling someone what to do, or, you know what I mean? And obviously there's different ways of framing that, but that, you know, a lot of players and really good players have built a body of work or could be in a game, do something really extraordinary or hard, and then can go to a teammate and say, hey, mate, you need to do that. Like, I've just shown you that I can do it. You need to do it. And then when you get into a coaching space, you don't have that as much anymore. You know, it becomes very verbal. And for me, I guess I was lucky because I knew I was going to be a coach pretty much as soon as I started playing. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a way better coach than I'm a player. So that was nice to have worked out pretty young. And then invested in learning the game, you know what I mean, studying the game and building myself as a coach to cover that, to have that collateral, to have that you know, fictitious money in the bank to say, hey, you need to do this, or can you do this, or let's try this. And not all players to coaches are doing that or understand that. It's like you need to redirect, you know, what you're doing in terms of continuing to be the model to be able to show players, teach players, direct players.
Well, you hit on a couple of really good points there, like the leading by example thing. Like, it's really easy to tell someone else to jump on a grenade if you've already jumped on that grenade beforehand. So you can lead by example, whereas what you're talking about now is the ability to go back and try and motivate differently. Like, in Roy Kent's example, That was a player that was at the top of his game that understood the problems that another player was going through, has understood like that yips mentality where, you know, we've all had that kid that cannot make a free throw for like 8 weeks straight and it costs you and it's like, don't highlight it. Yeah. I don't want to get in their head, you know, because then their confidence starts to wane too. There's a little bit more of an understanding because they've been through that as well. And, you know I have been critical of former players in the past coming straight into coaching and thinking they can coach. And it's like, that's not necessarily the same thing, but there is a lot of assumed and acquired knowledge before that point that they are very, very valuable to the sport. And usually it's just reps in coaching, and without, you know, spitballing too much, they usually go past the people that are just coaches, for lack of a better term. So it is really important to have someone that has at least been in those shoes a little bit and understand what can motivate, but how you also relate to people when they're going through harder moments that they may not understand.
Well, and it's not always when you're talking a little bit off topic, but when you're talking about players coming into coaching, just because you're an elite, let's say, basketball player, doesn't mean you're going to be an elite coach, because sometimes there's a disconnect between, you know, they have the ability to do these things that are just outstanding as players. Why can't you do that? You know, and it's becomes like a bit of a, and that's why sometimes they hate coaching. Like you speak to some players, you say, oh, you're going to get into coaching? No. It's just resounding no, which again is totally fine. But with what Coops was talking about as well, you know, when you're talking about age and, you know, you can obviously, you want somebody who's dialed in and connected and can reach those athletes if you are a bit older. Also have to be careful that they're not too close in age and they don't become friends. You know, at the end of the day, you know, yes, you need to build a relationship and all that sort of stuff, but you're not their friend. You're not, you know, like you're there to coach them. But one thing is, though, that you see with Ted and Beard is relationship building is ageless. Doesn't matter what age you are. If you're willing to put that time in to get to know someone, you might not be up with language or what's the new social media trend or whatever that might be. If that athlete knows that you care about them, doesn't matter how old or how young you are. That athlete will follow you and will, you know, walk through fire for you. And I think as long as you're willing to put in that time, it's going to speak volumes for you as a coach.
Yep. The other person that sort of tends to be around the group the most is Higgins. So Higgins is like the ops guy, for lack of a better term, that works for the club, that is a little bit of a go-between Rebecca, who owns the club, and the sort of the playing and the coaching group as well. Football knowledge seems to be okay. Is ultimately, though, a fan.
Yeah.
Like, enjoys the sport, enjoys the club, like, loves the club, in all honesty, but isn't looking for any credit. Like, gives his opinion when asked, but he's not forceful with it. Like, he's almost in the background, and I kind of get the impression that character is almost set up that way. And, you know, in a lot of cases, that can be similar to a team manager type role, that they've got a lot of opinions on things, but they're not always going to just throw them out there. They're supportive of everything that goes on. They have a real invested interest in what's going on with it. Usually a very good source of knowledge that can see things objectively, because the emotion is usually taken out of it from their end. They're not having to deal with a referee call or a player that's made a bad decision or something like that. They are able to sort of sit objectively, I suppose. And it's a really interesting sort of click that group has going on, is the Diamond Dogs, where there's the group of them where they're all fairly tight, and they talk about, you know, just emotions and what they're going through and problems that everyone else is having. And his context in that group, even though he's not involved with the football side of things, is actually so valuable, because he comes at it from a completely different perspective than all the others, with completely different experiences. When they're talking about high-end athletes, he has no, you know, value to give in that space. But when talking about, say, family and the connection that he has away from the pitch, that's where he really excels. And what it really highlighted to me was the need to have a diverse group of people around you that come from different backgrounds and different perspectives that almost keep you honest. Like, if you only hear the same stuff around you, well, that's the only thing you're going to think. Whereas he comes at it from a different angle, and it's like, well, actually, I hadn't thought about it this way. And his role in that group is just so valuable, I think, from my end.
Yeah, I think what I love about it, he's like a team manager is a perfect, I guess, if you're going to relate him to anybody as a team manager, because he's kind of like a bit of a dad to everybody, you know, whenever anyone's stuck or needs advice or anything like that. Or, you know, the Christmas I wasn't a massive fan of the Christmas episode. It didn't really make sense to me that it was in there in the middle of September or whatever it was. But all the athletes, all the players going to his, like him opening up his home to all the athletes, but mainly for the international athletes who can't go home for Christmas because they play and train over that time and all that sort of stuff was just, it's just lovely. He's just so giving and he's just really happy to be there. And there's no, there doesn't seem to be any just nastiness about him. There's no, no agenda. He's not trying to take anyone's job or get anyone sacked. And obviously he was drawn in early in the Rebecca plot, I guess. But you could see he was visibly uncomfortable with that as well and ends up taking a stand against that. Which again speaks volumes to having that sort of person around who hears something they don't like about an agenda that's going to be hurtful to you and says, nah, I'm not having that. So, yeah, I think, I mean, we say we all need a beard around us, we all need a Higgins as well.
No question. You got a Higgins in your life there, Coops?
You know what? I've had so many. I've been so lucky to have a number of Higginses, you know, along the way.
I think the plural is Higgy.
I think it's a Leslie of Higginses.
A Leslie of Higginses. Brilliant. Yeah, you know, just really great club people or team managers that you know, take you to a place of joy when you're down. That can bring you back to reality if you're too high, can speak to you from a perspective that maybe you haven't had before. And people that that also, you know, like players especially will naturally gravitate to. So, you know, some shout outs. Mark Sainsbury is a good one for me. Kaz Saddleton, who we had this year, she was fantastic. Toby Conroy up in AIS, like there's all these guys and girls that have just been these amazing people. And I think us as coaches, don't forget our responsibility to show those people what they mean to us, you know, because most of the time they're volunteers, you know what I mean? And yeah, just help build those people in your life, help build those people in your team and just never forget what they can bring to the table.
Yeah, really valuable point though. Like they are the volunteers around the club in a lot of cases that just want to be there to help. It's, and we see it a lot with obviously senior basketball. You know, there's a lot of resources that go into seniors, generally speaking. So they're the people that man the door, that clean the floors, like those kinds of things that just get stuff done that people take for granted. And like you see Higgins in particular, like he keeps getting bounced around offices because someone always needs his space. So his reaction is no, I will move. Not, yeah. No, that's my space and you can't have it. So he is an absolute giver. And when you look at a lot of the people that are involved here, when you look at the energy givers versus the energy takers, like that whole coaching staff are just energy givers. Like they are trying to help out someone along the way as well. And that's such an important area to be for a lot of coaches because you have to be that leader.
Except that Nate. In season two, like that, we were speaking about it before we started recording. That conversation between Ted and him towards the end where he starts crying and saying, you know, you started ignoring me and oh my goodness, if I could jump through a TV and punch someone in the face, like it was just, but that's, again, we've spoken about it a little bit already, but that's forgetting what somebody has done for you. And you know, the, what have you done for me lately rather than what just amazing what you've done for me. And letting that then manifest and get and become a beast.
Well, and a big part of that too is Nate not realizing that Ted's got his own problems.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a really important part of it as coaches. And I'm looking at the time. We've gone comfortably over an hour. So we will be coming back for next week with part two with this rather than continuing on. But it is really looking after yourself and understanding that other people have things going on as well. They can't always be emotionally or physically available to you 100% of the time. There is more stuff going on in people's lives. And yes, it may have felt like he let you down, that sort of stuff. And to Ted's credit, he owned that. Like, he didn't sit there and fight back because he was trying to be the sponge, I suppose, for what Nate needed at that time. And that, I mean, that shows a lot of character straight away from a coach that's able to put their stuff to the side and be what they needed to be at that point in time. Like, that was, for mine, really impressive as well. So that's a little bit of an overall of the creating a team and the culture and the support people around you. That is where we'll end it for this week because I've still got a page and a half worth of notes that we haven't got through and we've already tipped over the hour mark. So we're coming back next week, Coops.
Well, and if you've learned anything, watch the show. It's amazing.
You got a week. Like, binge it. I know we're coming out of lockdown this week, but binge it. Like, you've still got time. It's going to rain. Like, you'll be okay. It's not a problem at all. So, Coops, Zoe, thanks for jumping in this week. We will be back for part two of the Ted Lasso podcast and lessons we can learn from Lasso. There you go. Lessons from Lasso. Like, that's the name of the podcast. Like, there we go.
That just happened.
Who knew that was possible? So, coaches, thanks very much for listening. Despite my rant on social media, maybe email people the podcast and tell them to go and listen to it or send them a text message. Like, there are other ways that you can help share the podcast. But if you are determined to use social media, the hashtag Talking Split will always get my attention. So if you need anything, by all means, just reach out and we will catch all you coaches next week. Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.